to MGO Michigan Pod Hockey Non-Sports Cast or something, whatever this is. It's number 28 of Season 3. Wow, Season 3. And, oh yeah, we're going to talk about the Michigan Draft. Alexander Drain, you are still here. How was your summer?
It's been pretty good.
Yeah? What have you been doing?
Not a ton.
No?
Nope, just...
But you graduated, so this is kind of like the part, right?
Something like that.
Something like that. Wimbledon? Did you Wimbledon?
I watched Wimbledon, yeah.
We kind of kicked around an idea of like doing a draft, but it just never really came into fruition.
Yeah, I didn't.
Fruition?
Fruition. Didn't really have the... Guess the reason to.
Well, yeah, there was really nothing else. Had this happened, you know, a month ago or something. Baseball, though. You're into baseball. Aren't you a Blue Jays fan these days?
Blue Jays, Tigers fan.
Tigers are making a run for a while.
Tigers have had a real up and down season. Blue Jays have just been the same thing, where it's three games over 500, one game over 500, five games over 500, three games over 500. It's just up and down, never really deviating from the same spot. Tigers were on track to have an all-time bad season through about 35 points, or 35 games, rather. And
are you still have hockey on the brain?
Yeah. And then it's been genuinely pretty good since then. You know, had a tough weekend against KC this past weekend, but we're on a seven-game winning streak before that. And,
yeah.
You know, it's I think it really has proven the importance of pro development. A lot of people are of the belief that managers in baseball really don't do that much, which I generally was in the past.
Yeah.
When it comes to in-game decisions and bullpen management, I think they don't really make a big difference. And there isn't really a ton of schematic difference in the way there can be for football and other sports. But a really good manager and a really good team of assistants can have a big impact when it comes to developing players at the pro level.
Yeah.
That, you know, too many people just think that the minor leagues do all the developing in baseball.
Like, once you get to a certain point, it's then, just about learning your assignment and not getting better.
But so many players on this roster have gotten a lot better than they were at the start of the season, particularly on the pitching side, and they're just playing way above their talent level right now.
I mean, that's...
So...
That's good.
It's on ownership to spend the money to get more players and that sort of thing moving forward. But finally, for the first time in a long time, there is optimism within the fan base.
Hmm.
Which could also be said for the Pistons, who won the draft lottery.
That's true.
We have the draft on Thursday, very stressful last month, but coming to an end. And we'll see if they make the obvious choice.
And you have your opinion on that.
I mean, I think pretty much everyone does. I've scoured the internet, and I have found zero internet scouts who have Cade Cunningham below one overall. So
that is generally the consensus. So will the Blue Jays make the playoffs? Because you've been pretty Blue Jaysing.
Probably not.
You don't think so?
Maybe, but it's always felt like they have the potential to go on a run, but there's just always some issue. And they have this gaudy run differential, but... You know, this weekend series against the Mets was kind of the full Blue Jays experience, where you have the Friday game where the offense just doesn't really show up, really impatient at bats, 1-2-pitch ground outs and fly outs, young hitters really chomping at the bit. Then you have the Saturday game where it's just the offense is flowing, and that's how you get that run differential where they win whatever it is, 10-3 or something, and put up six home runs on a good pitcher, by the way. And then... And then Sunday, you know, it's a tight game. They have a lead going into the later innings, and the bullpen doesn't get it done. And so you exit the weekend winning the series in run differential, but coming out 1-2. And
that's kind of the interesting thing about some of that stuff, right? It's like you have to look at like when you score your runs. I mean, like, I know you've been like quoting the Pythagorean theorem all, or baseball version of it all summer to me, but it's sometimes like when you have those sort of outbursts, like... I get the point of, it's like Michigan's goals, right? Like, we were talking about that this past year.
The Blue Jays are a lot like Michigan hockey this past season in terms of that. You know, it's interesting because you have the A's, who are, I think, coming back to kind of where they are as a good team, but not a great team.
Yeah.
The Yankees are probably cooked.
And
then, you know, I just don't really think there's any other people are in the hunt, you know, seriously. You have the Mariners who have
come out of nowhere.
The Mariners are the anti-Blue Jays.
Yeah.
The Mariners have a run differential that is awful. I think it's like negative 50-something.
Yeah.
And yet they are 1.5 out of the wild card in a ton of games over 500. They're at like a 70% winning percentage in games decided by one run. Whereas the Blue Jays are at a 35% in games decided by two runs or less.
That's an interesting thing to me, is that, like, you look at that and you think, oh, that's bad luck. And there probably is a lot of that in it, too. You're just not getting the hit or whatever. But, you know, somebody made an interesting point. I was listening to a podcast in the fall about, like, coin flip games in football. And he was saying that sometimes it just comes down to if you have a great quarterback. Meaning, like, if you get the ball at a certain time, he knows what kind of drive to put together and how to keep the ball but keep it moving and that sort of thing. So could this be, in baseball, sort of, like, could the bullpen be that version of it?
Yeah, it has been proven over time that teams with better bullpens overperform the Pythagorean theorem. That's not shocking. But what is interesting is that when you look at the Blue Jays' bullpen ERA, it's actually not bad. I think it's like 13th out of 30 teams.
What's close to average.
But what the thing about it is that they don't lose a lot of blowouts. So, like, what happens is the bullpen is really good at keeping them in games. It's really good at shutting the opponent down when they're winning by a ton. But it just cracks when they're in a big moment. And that's kind of the problem. They're also entering the weekend, they were the second worst team in late and close game situations in OPS. This magic, you know, this great offense sinks to a 630 team OPS in situations where they're either up by a run, down by a run.
Is that random?
In late game situations. Mostly, but when you pair that with a bullpen that has blown games at inopportune times, that's how you get 35% winning percentage in games decided by two runs or less. So
that's true.
It's kind of just this unfortunate tandem, but it is what it is.
My Mets are kind of, you're talking about the anti-Blue Jays. That's sort of like the Mets, where now they starting to hit a little bit more, which brings me to my next last opening question here. But, like, you know, their pitching has been great, their bullpen has been phenomenal, and then every once in a while they get a few runs, and so they're in every game, but, like, it's just, you know, you could have guys in second and third and nobody out, and you all game and you get like two runs because nobody was hitting. My last question is, do you think they switch the balls at the All-Star game? Because scoring has just, like, absolutely ballooned. Like, not just, oh, yeah, no, we got a few more runs. But, like, everybody's hitting bombs.
I don't know. I haven't really followed it too closely, so I don't have an answer for that.
You want to take a side?
Not really. What I will say also
is
that... Are
you going to punt? Craig would be really disappointed if you punted.
The Blue Jays and the Mets are, you know, opposites of each other also, because the Mets play in a god-awful division, and the Blue Jays would love to move to that division, you know, because the NL East and the AL East are facing each other this year,
right.
And just watching the way the AL East teams have pulverized anybody who's not the Mets in that division.
Well, the rest of that division is...
Yeah. Whereas, you know, in the AL East, you have the Yankees who, while severely underperforming, are still an above 500 team.
Depending on when this podcast goes.
The Rays are...
Rays are good.
They're still a really good team. They don't hit very well, but they get big opportune hits. They have a lot of power. You know, guys like Mike Zunino who can't hit his weight, but he can suddenly hit 35 home runs in
and
a
season.
Their
bullpen consists of about 20 players.
Their whole pitching staff is just 18 players who pitch three innings each and all have ERAs sub 3.
Is that the future of baseball?
Maybe. And then you have the Red Sox, who are back to having that one season every 4 years where everything goes right and they win a World Series. So,
yeah, I don't know that they have the pitching. I mean,
I don't think they're real, but I also remember 2013 and 2018, these random seasons where they weren't good the year before and weren't good the year after, but every few years they have a 100-win season where everything goes right, and we just have to live with it.
Man, it is very different than it was 30 or 40 years ago where we're just talking about plural World Series for
one day,
the Red Sox.
That will be the Detroit Lions.
All right. One last quick little note that we need to get to before we actually start the meat of our podcast is that we have a sponsor. We are sponsored by Michigan Law Grad, criminal attorney Jonathan Paul. If you find yourself a little out over your skates, go to MichiganLawGrad.com. Have you ever been out over your skates?
No.
Literally or figuratively?
I have not been in any criminal situations.
When were
I have been in civil lawsuits, you, but not criminal lawsuits.
When were you last on skates?
Ice skates?
It's not specific. You could be on any sort
I mean,
of
I rollerblade some.
Do you?
Yeah.
Still?
Yeah.
Interesting. What about ice skates?
Well, a lot of the rinks have been, you know, not like normal in the last year or so.
Well, okay.
So.
But like, I mean, leading up to that, were you avid...
Not really. I've been trying to improve my skating over the past couple of years.
It is kind of fun to go out with some bros, some friends, and skate around a little bit anyway. So I think this is the time that we should commence the giggling, because if you were watching the NHL draft on Friday, it just seemed like Michigan players were going to go and go and go and go. And that's kind of what they did. This isn't like a preview, because we're going to go through some of these players. It's not going to be like we're going to break down who they are and what they did, all of them, because we've done that to an extent, and we will in a few months. But it's just kind of like something to enjoy as Michigan, either current Wolverines or, you know, very, very, very short-term future Wolverines, went 1, 2, 4, 5, and 24 in the fourth round, or the first round, and then... I believe Dylan Duke went at the end of the fourth round, so yep. That would be like, I don't know.
It was 128.
128. All right. So 6 in the top 128, 4 in the top 5, 5 in the top 24. And, I mean, has this ever happened? And has Alabama or Duke or any of these, like, supposed powerhouse schools over the past few years done this in any sport? Like, I don't remember that. And I generally watch drafts.
I mean, Alabama and Ohio State have had some years where they had, like, 8 in the top in the first round.
Right. But four of the top five?
No, that's pretty rare.
That's insane.
There's a piece that I've put up about the draft that will probably be on the site by the time you listen to this. it was the first time since 69 that two players from the same junior team went 1-2 in the draft.
Right.
In the NHL draft. You want to guess who those two were? You're not going to get them.
I probably won't.
Regine Hole and Mark Tardif.
Wow, we would have been here a long time if you were expecting
from the Montreal Junior Canadiens. It's been a while since there was this kind of dominance at the time. I mean, there have been years where there were two guys on a team, like McDavid's year. He played on Erie with one of the Stroms, I want to say.
Yeah.
And there's been a number of years where there were two really good guys on, like, the London Knights, who were a dominant program
in the OHL. Which happens a lot with London.
There was the year in 13 when there was the crazy Halifax team with MacKinnon and Jonathan Drouin, who went 1-3 in that draft. So there have been some years, but those are, like, two in the top three or two in the top five.
Right.
Not...
And two is like,
four.
I mean, that's happened in sports too. I mean, like Courtney Brown and LeVar Arrington, went like both top five. Two is something. Three is like crazy. And we were kind of expecting three in the top five-ish, six. But then when Kent Johnson went five, which is maybe a little bit of a reach.
Well,
for him.
Johnson was the question mark because, you know, I knew Power was going to go one. I knew Beniers was going to go somewhere in the top five. Hughes was on the fringe, but it seemed like in the days leading up to the draft that the Devils were going to take him.
If no one else did.
If no one else did.
No one else being Anaheim, I guess.
Yeah, or the Kraken. I actually thought the Kraken were more likely to take him than Anaheim. But Johnson was the question mark. He was down, I think, at 9 on the McKenzie list. But McKenzie acknowledged that multiple scouts he surveyed, and these are scouts who work for NHL teams, had Johnson in their top five. And Scott Wheeler of The Athletic, who is a decent internet scout, had him number 3 on his board. McKenzie talked about that after Power, there was the group of 8 prospects, 2 through 9, and they did go 2 through 9 in this draft, that kind of everyone had their own ranking of the 8, and that there was kind of a 4 and then 4, and Johnson was in the second 4, but he acknowledged that one in that second 4 could very easily go in the top 5, and Johnson was that guy. So...
And Johnson kind of has the high-end upside of this draft.
Like,
you don't know what you're going to get. You know that he does. You always would say in the fall, he does one thing really, really,
really
well.
Yeah, he has a projectable skill. And, you know, there are some scouts who are concerned about size, playing on the perimeter, pace of play, decision-making. Those are all concerns I had. But there are other scouts who see the hands. They see... the highlight reel passes, and they think this is Mitch Marner. And, you know, maybe one day he will grow up to be a guy who doesn't score playoff goals. So
I think that was one of the last times we touched.
It's the roast Marner season right now.
So we'll just run through these really quick.
And Leafs fans are the ones doing the most roasting, too.
Well, I mean, that sounds like Leafs fans. Yeah. But so Owen Power goes 1 to Buffalo. Not really a surprise. That was all but guaranteed for a while.
He was 10 out of 10 on the McKenzie poll.
Matty Beniers goes 2 to Anaheim. I wrote to Anaheim. Kraken. Wow, it's definitely Seattle. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing. So he goes to Seattle. Not a big surprise there either. He's probably, some would say, maybe the most, complete, well-rounded player?
Yeah, he has a very polished game. You know, upside might not be as high, but it's definitely a safer pick. And in a draft where a lot of guys played 20 games for some team, you know, you had the OHL prospects playing in the Slovak League and the Swiss League. You know, the Dub played, I think, 24 games. I think the Q played 28, maybe. Michigan played
24.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, in that range.
They should have played 25.
You know, there was very little tape on a lot of these guys. Right. And so in an uncertain draft year, Beniers' safe nature really appealed to teams.
And then Luke Hughes goes 4. Luke Hughes is not, I mean, I guess he's a Michigan Wolverine because he has probably, I assume, signed his NLI. But, like, he's going to be a freshman next year. He's a defenseman that goes to New Jersey. And like you were saying, not really a surprise there either, as they have a number of forwards to build around.
They were going
to
take a defenseman.
Getting a defenseman there.
It was going to be the question of whether it was Hughes, Edvinson, or Brant Clark. And I think the combination of having Jack on the roster made it impossible to pass up.
Jack Hughes might have been the only person more excited than Luke Hughes.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on there. It was kind
he
of
jumps
like,
off the couch and is going absolutely nuts.
His lower body was doing a lot of work there. It was kind of like a half twerking video, half celebration video.
And then 5, as we mentioned, was KJ, Kent Johnson, or KJ as we affectionately call him, to Columbus. And that was sort of probably the biggest surprise of those 5. And at that point, you're just like, what is even going on? Like, I was expecting Samuskevich to go in the top 10 at this rate because, like, just the way that Michigan players are flying off the board, this is just a... I never really don't remember anything really like this. And it is prompted at a hockey cast at the end of July, which is setting all sorts of records, I think, at MGO Blog.
Yep.
But, and then the next guy was Mackie Samuskevich. I think it's Samuskevich. That's what I've heard the most times.
I like Samuskevich more, but it appears to be Samuskevich.
Well, maybe you can talk to the family and they can then switch their name. I'm going to call him Samo because I'm not going to tweet and type Samuskevich all the time. Like, my name is Nasternak and I do love my name, but I also hate typing it. You apparently do not have that problem, Drain.
No.
No, it's relatively easy for you.
Yeah.
So, but he goes 24th, which I don't think that's like a shock, but it was still a little early for him. Maybe
that was right in line.
Was it? I thought I saw some stuff with him in the early second.
I think the McKenzie list had him at 32, but there were a number of internet scouts who had him higher than that. So it was definitely a possibility. Also, by the way, he was the 23rd selection, but the 24th pick in the draft because the Coyotes forfeited the 11th pick. So there were a lot of questions about whether we call every pick after that the number or the number of selection it is.
Okay.
It was the 24th pick, but the 23rd name off the board.
Do you have an opinion on that?
I think they should have just slid everyone up and called that pick 23. Just everyone moved up one beyond that.
But they didn't.
They didn't.
They just said that Arizona picked no one.
At 11, yes.
At 11.
They picked and forfeited. So then,
yeah. I mean, I guess... I mean, what is... I mean, we have a history of teams forfeiting picks?
Well, the Blues refused to participate in a draft in the 1980s.
Well, that's slightly different, though. That's not being allowed to pick versus choosing to not pick.
Yeah. They were mad that they weren't allowed to move.
The Astros didn't pick in the MLB draft a couple weeks ago. So there's only 31 first-round picks.
Yeah, that but happens more in the MLB. Well, also, the MLB, if you don't sign the guy, then you get the extra pick the next year.
Oh, yeah.
Which happened to the Astros years back when they picked Brady Aiken, I think it was. They didn't sign him. Then they got the extra top 5 pick the next year. So they got 2 in the top 5.
Didn't he win American Idol?
No, that was Clay Aiken.
Oh.
Yeah. And they used the second one to pick, I think the first one they had that year was Bregman, and the second one was Tucker. But
Well, those are pretty good picks.
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah.
But I think in the MLB draft this year, there's only 31 first-round picks. So they did it a little bit differently than the NHL did.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting. I think the next thing that we should talk about is, and this has been talked about a lot, and we've theorized on it even going back to that wonderful day that Michigan had to forfeit their game in the NCAA tournament. But, I mean, it seems like everyone's coming back.
Well, there was a roster that was discreetly published recently.
MGO Blue roster.
Yes, there was no announcement. They just slipped it out there that suddenly you could, you know, click on the tab and bring up the 21.
Like Dave Brandon at 1 a.m.
21-22 roster.
Is it still there?
It's still there.
And everyone, I presume, is...
All of the players that we know that haven't left are there. So, like, obviously, Jack Becker is not there.
But okay, sure.
Everyone else...
Strassman, I assume,
is not there. Yes, Strassman is not there. But everybody else is there, and their ages have been moved up. So they all say sophomore instead of freshman now.
Do they have numbers?
Yes. Oh. The only people who don't have numbers are the freshmen.
Okay.
But they're all listed, just at the bottom, with no picture and no number.
Huh. I wonder if that's, like, trying to, like, motivate everyone to come back.
Well, the thing is that the draft normally... You know, would happen in the third to fourth week of June, and then you'd get a month to kind of make a decision.
Yeah.
I was looking this up for reference when I was writing my piece. Quinn Hughes announced he was coming back in 18, July the 28th.
Which is in two days.
Yes. And that's different than this year, because July 28th is only like 5 days after the draft. But classes start August 31st.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have all day to decide.
No, you have about a month.
Yeah. If that, because, like, you still have to register and stuff.
Well,
I mean, they'll make up a few classes you pretend to take, but, you know, you have to enroll at least in a few, and, you know, Michigan students have enrolled in classes a long time ago, so.
So, Len, I mean, we've touched on this a little bit. We'll rehash it a little bit more now. It kind of makes sense for most of these guys to come back. Like even from a professional organization standpoint, all right, let's start with Owen Power to Buffalo. Okay. Buffalo's trading everyone. I mean, there's rumors that Eichel's going to be traded. They traded Reinhardt. They traded Risto, which made you laugh. And so they're not going to be very good next year.
Yeah, well, Buffalo, I mean, the thing that was, I think, the most reassuring to people just watching the draft is how every time Michigan guys were picked, it was like, well, he should no way, like, come to the NHL next year.
Yeah.
And, like, this is not people with an interest. These are internet scouts. These are... you know, random people like that. And, you know, there really seems to be, I mean, and it's the way it should be. Like, Power, I do think, has something to gain in coming back.
Well, he was very young at the beginning of his freshman.
Right, and his ability, I think, to show that he can play a little more physically and also direct more offense from the back end with York being gone. He'll have more of a role on the power play, you have to think. So I think there are some things he could really improve on. And obviously Buffalo doesn't have a lot of reason to rush him into the NHL, in part because, by all accounts, they are going to tank next year.
And they can bump his ELC entry-level contract by a year up to when he's 20, right? Like, they can still move it along. So for them to start that early for next year is, a lot of ways, a waste of a year.
I said a little ways back, I don't remember if it's on a podcast or where, but... You know, the biggest thing about whether Power would be rushed to the NHL is whether they would be trading Reinhardt and, you know, whole kit and caboodle.
And they traded Reinhardt and Risto.
Yeah.
So, and if they can work out a deal for Eichel, I mean, you and I are both guessing he's going to be a Ranger or a King or, I don't know,
what's the
singular of a Wild?
Yeah.
Wild?
Or a Duck. We've heard those rumors.
Really?
Montreal, maybe. There's a lot of names out there. But GMs are balking at the idea that you have to give up good prospects to get Jack Eichel.
Why? Okay.
I love following trade negotiations.
Yeah, that's... All right. So Powers, I mean, and he has even said he's leaning to coming back.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Matty Beniers.
Beniers is the one guy that I think...
has the highest percent chance to go.
The guy that I think doesn't actually have much reason to be in college again. I don't really know what he's going to gain from being here a second year. Like,
you mean from a professional development standpoint?
Yeah, I don't know what he's going to... improve on. Like, what is maybe being more dynamic, I guess? I don't know. Like,
well, so part of it, I think, and this is maybe like the romantic side of it, but part of it is you get a lot of people are seemingly going to come back. There's almost no reason for guys like Bortolo, Brisson, Beecher to sign now. I mean, I guess something new in their lives could develop or whatever, but like all these guys are coming back. The team is absolutely stacked, and like, well, not getting to play in the tournament, the romantic side says,
sure.
I mean, we're going to have like the best chance to win however many banners you want to count.
Well, so I also think that Beniers, we know a lot about, is an academic guy.
Yeah. Well, he flipped from Harvard, as we've said before.
Right. He had a very high GPA this past year, apparently. He's enrolled in real classes, all those sorts of things. Yeah. He is here to play school. So that, I think, has a factor in this, you know, situation in terms of wanting to come back.
Sure. And there, and I don't think it's an accident that he went from Harvard to Michigan.
No.
Yeah. So I think that it still, in a lot of ways, makes sense for him to come back. He did mention...
It also isn't clear what direction the Kraken franchise is going in. They had a very odd expansion draft. They kind of...
Did you... Well, we watched that, right? That was...
It was an interesting production.
That was an interesting...
Because they picked some guys to make their team better right away. I mean, they picked Oleksiak and signed him. They picked Larson and signed him.
Yeah.
They took the flyer on Eberle. They took Yanni Gord as opposed to a Ross Colton or someone like that.
Yeah.
So they seem to be trying to field a good team, but they also really built up a lot of cap space, didn't take any side deals when they could have. I mean, they took a guy from the Flyers that may or may not be a fake person. And when they had the option to take, you know, James Van Riemsdyk or Jakub Voracek. And,
right, like a win-now player.
Yeah, and but they didn't get a side deal to do that. They just took... They really hoarded cap space, and so maybe they're going to go out there and offer Dougie Hamilton $12 million per year.
Yes. As,
you know, the offer you can't refuse to get a guy. I mean, I don't know. We'll see what they're doing, but it's not really clear what the plan is.
But even then...
Because if you wanted to tank for Shane Wright or... You know, and ensure that you get some high picks the next few years when you have Bedard and Michkov and all the other players coming to the draft, you would have just taken the rando from every team, yeah. Then taken, you know, the Andrew Ladd contract to get to the cap floor and just said, we're going to win like 10 games next year. Or you spend up to the cap, load up on the good players, and say, we're going to try and win 100 points, you know, next year. But they just kind of did the in-between.
Both.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't know what the plan is.
So that's the next thing, is like, when you're looking at some of these... Okay, so we talked about Beniers. The next two are pretty easier to discuss. Luke Hughes, I mean, he's coming to Michigan.
Yeah,
like,
there's
he's
no
not,
question about that.
He's not
he's also got
signing.
He's recovering from an injury.
And he also mentioned something about wanting to come and win a national title.
Yeah,
and
I mean, there's no way he's
Kent
coming.
Johnson is like the one guy that we said all along.
He needs to bulk up. He needs,
yeah, there's a lot for him to prove next year, especially yeah. being a top five pick. So those guys are definitely going to be here. Beniers is sort of the one that you think maybe would.
And anyone
but,
outside the top four is coming to Michigan.
But
Samoskevich is coming to Michigan. Dylan Duke is coming to Michigan, etc.
If everybody is coming back, there's the part of it that's like everyone's ragging on Beniers. Like, come on, one more year, man. Let's go do something, and then you can go be the 2C in Seattle for the next decade or whatever. But so the last thing that I want to touch on with this is that like there are. Like this year was not a year that had probable, like, McKinnon, Matthews, McDavid at the top, right?
Correct.
This is not that kind of a draft. Next year could be a little different. Like, there's a guy or two.
There's guys higher. It depends on who you talk to.
Yeah.
The 22 draft was always held up as the big one, and now all of a sudden, kind of, it's the, like, the meme with the guy and the two girls where... Now, all of a sudden, he's looking at the 23 draft, and that's kind of the hockey community. Because Connor Bedard has kind of stolen Shane Wright's thunder when it comes to the next great guy in the CHL. I mean, what he did this season was unbelievable.
But he's a 23.
23. And then you also have Matvei Michkov in Russia, who did some unbelievable things at the U18s as a 15, 16-year-old. So now people are kind of looking to that draft, but
Shane
Wright still exists. Wright
yeah.
scored at Connor McDavid's pace at the same age in the same league.
Yeah.
However, the thing that really hurt Wright is that the OHL didn't play this year. So we didn't see much of him.
So this is from 2 years ago.
Yeah. He showed up at the U18s and did really well as an underager and everything. But like the OHL is going to have a season this year. If he goes out and slaughters it, we'll be right back in the Shane Wright hype
yeah.
train.
So... there is still Shane Wright, and that's sort of what I meant is that...
Yeah, and there's some other guys. Brad Lambert over in Finland I like a lot. Matthew Savoie, who played in the USHL this year, but is normally in the WHL. So that'll be interesting to follow.
Sure. So that moves us on to our next point, which I just will touch on briefly here, is that you've sent me a couple of these now, but you have a projected lineup, and I'm just going to kind of read it, and we'll fill in the blanks as we go. But so you just said, okay, so now that everyone's been drafted, this is more or less what our team should be, and that's the first line is going to be a first-round pick, a second-round pick, and a first-round pick. And those, I assume you mean, are Brisson, Bortolo, and Samo?
Yeah, I'm not sure where Samoskevich.
We're going to do this
well,
all year.
Well, it's the new Brisson. will slot in the lineup. He's more of an offense-only guy who is a decent skater and can do a lot of things. I'm not sure. I think that line, honestly, you might prefer a body who can crash the net and who can retrieve the puck. And I think actually like a Nick Granowitz or an Eric Ciccolini might be better there, but I don't know.
But that's still an option.
Yeah.
The second line, you had first round top five, and then seventh round. And that's clearly Beniers, KJ, and then probably Ciccolini.
I actually think Duke might fit better there. I was reading more on him today.
Man, this is just all curveballs.
Well, it's you know, I'm a coach, so.
Because you're not a scout?
You know, you sit the whole summer and you're just shuffling the lineup in your head.
Yeah.
Because Duke is a natural goal scorer. He had 29 goals to 20 assists this season. And that line, you need a shooter. Because Johnson isn't really a shooter. Beniers isn't really. They have the skill to create.
And that's why Ciccolini.
Ciccolini is too. But if Duke's a better shooter and a little more high-end talent, then maybe he fits there.
Third line you had is a fourth, a first, and Pasta, which is Duke, Beecher, and then...
Yeah, the long-forgotten Johnny Beecher. Yeah. Still on the third line.
He's still at Michigan, too.
Yeah.
If you would have told me 2 years ago he'd be potentially probably going to be here for his third year, I would have been a little surprised. But
so that's where you could put Samo, because if you say, okay, Beecher isn't really a high-skill offensive guy who's driving play offensively, you could drop Samo there to then be the line driver offensively. Yeah. That's an option.
And then the fourth line is Demoyle, Van Wy, and then we're kind of like flipping it here with like
Granowitz, Lambert, Morgan. It's just a revolving door.
Yeah.
Marcus Stoppa. I don't know. What's his face? Lapointe. Girl's gone. He could be an option too.
All those guys.
They put Lapointe there last year, so he could fit.
When Raby was out,
What I will say about that, and this is true for the defense too, is that it's got more talent than last year, but also vastly more experience, which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because last year's team had the experience problem, where all of your top scorers were freshmen. And in this case, all but a few starters would be sophomores or higher. You would have like three or four freshman starters. And in the cases where you do not have a NHL-drafted guy, it's exclusively seniors and in some cases juniors, in some cases fifth-year guys who have a ton of experience, right? Like Pasta, Garrett Van Wy, Moyle.
Van Wy's only a fourth year, I think.
Yeah, Van Wy and Moyle are fourth years. Pastajov's fifth year. But if those
Pasta and Morgan is the other guy you're thinking of.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just saying, like, those are all seniors to fifth-year players who have 4 to 5 years of college hockey experience.
Right.
Same thing on the defense with Blankenberg, right? Like, where you have, and even Jack Summers, third-year guy. Keaton Pearson, I think, is a third-year guy. Or Summers
Pearson
a fourth.
Summers will be fourth.
Fourth, yeah. So
you have, now you're getting, like, seniors and talent.
Yeah.
Instead of being some young talent with some sophomores, juniors.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll run through the pairings that we kind of guessed. It's going to be a top five, or first overall top five with Blankenberg, which obviously is power. And that's going to be the number one pairing.
That's going to be
maybe the best pairing in college hockey.
I don't know. I haven't looked around college hockey enough to say that, but probably.
Find me two better than the number one overall.
I mean, that's going to be your Nicholas Lidstrom-Brian Rafalski pairing, where they're playing like 29 minutes in big games.
And then you have a first-round pick, top five overall, and a fifth-round pick. And that's going to be
Luke Hughes
and Ethan Edwards?
No. Jacob Truscott.
Truscott, that's right.
Yeah.
Edwards is the fourth.
Because you're going to need a safety blanket on Luke Hughes. Hughes has...
And Truscott was... That's kind of what he was last year.
To some extent,
Pretty safe in his own zone.
Yeah.
Not super flashy. Not a puck breakout. But you need somebody...
Luke plays a game similar to Quinn, but even maybe a little more rough defensively at this point in time. He has a lot of room to grow there. And so you're going to need someone to help him out.
And that's kind of interesting because, like, I think... There's a bunch of Michigan fans that grew stale with Luke or Quinn by the end of his career, but the thing there was that Quinn was like the only defenseman that could really do anything, and he was on the top pair. So now if you have that from your second pair, that's different than having it as like, all right, you're our only defenseman, go do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the third pair we had is a fourth round and Summers or Person, and two guys that are relatively established, and a fourth round pick in
Ethan Edwards.
Yeah. And then the third round goalie in Portillo.
Portillo, by the way, was fifth off the board from the goaltender position in his draft, which, you know, is roughly akin to like a late first talent at another position.
So that's seven first round picks, one second round pick, one third, one fourth.
Two fourths,
a fifth and a seventh.
Yep. So I think 13 drafted guys out of 19
and
starters.
And not a bunch of guys in the sixth round.
No.
That's insane.
It's a lot of talent, and now it's up to Mel to put the pieces together.
Maybe even more expectations.
Sure.
You made a quick list. We'll run through these kind of quick. You made a list of some other people in the Big Ten that got drafted that are probably going to be eye-turners next year.
There were two other first rounders in the Big Ten. Chaz Lucius is going to Minnesota, was picked 18th by Winnipeg, and then Corson Kulemans, defenseman going to Wisconsin, was picked 25th by Columbus. And then a lot of guys sort of after that. Notre Dame had two in the later rounds, including the third Pastashov brother, Sasha.
Who some people have said might be the best.
I mean, he's definitely better in terms of his draft.
Well, that's true.
Position.
One wasn't drafted, and the other one was like sixth or seventh round.
Yeah. PSU had one guy. Wisconsin had, I think, one more guy in the later rounds. Minnesota had a pretty healthy group, two or three guys in the second through fourth round.
Which is pretty typical of Minnesota.
Yep. OSU had none. MSU had none. So that was the Big Ten survey about what we would expect from the teams given the way they've recruited in the past. Otherwise, it was mostly the usual suspects in terms of college hockey, draft picks.
Hockey East teams.
Hockey East teams plus Denver and NODAC. So.
Yep. Did you want to get into anything the Wings did? I know you were kind of excited about a couple of the picks they had
for
our local listeners.
Yeah, you know, they took Simon Edvinson in the first round, pick sixth. Edvinson is a swing, and that was kind of...
You wanted Eklund, didn't you?
I wanted Eklund, but I understand why you might want Edvinson. You know, it was definitely a draft where the theme seemed to be swinging for the fences, and Edvinson is a guy who, to me, there's a lot of different ways his career could unfold, and it really depends on what help and nurturing he gets from player development, because there are scenarios where he is Eric Goodbranson, and then there are scenarios where he is a lot better than that, and it's all about who you have to make sure you're fixing some of the problems that are in his game. And, I think the Wings trust their player development group, and it'll be very interesting, but he won't be in the NHL for a while. That is a long-term pick.
They got another first-round pick, right? They traded up?
Well, they already had a second first in the Mantha deal, and then they moved a second to get even higher into the first to take their preferred goaltender prospect, Sebastian Kosa.
He was sort of like the number one goalie on a lot of people's boards?
No, Volstadt was number one boards, yes.
Okay.
There were rumors moving... it was kind of weird going into the draft because McKenzie had kind of said, well, you know, Jesper Volstadt could go in the top 10 and be the first top 10 goalie, I think, since Carey Price, or he might be the second goalie off the board. Which was a bizarre kind of duality because there was a small group of teams that had him super high, and then there was another group of teams like the Red Wings that didn't even have him number one on their goalie board. And Kosa, he fits the mold. Everyone thought it was going to be Volstedt because of the Swedish thing, but Kosa fits the profile of what Yzerman wanted in Tampa. His two goalies there were Ben Bishop and Andre Vasilevsky, both of whom are big goalies.
Yeah.
And Volstedt wasn't very big, wasn't very athletic, kind of a brainy goalie who relies on, you know, reflexes and puck tracking ability. Kosa is your 6'6", super athletic,
behemoth,
highly projectable goalie. And then again, it's another sort of high upside, maybe longer term swing for the fences. And you know, I think they just kind of said, well, this is a year where there's a lot of uncertainty, and
we're going to go with the big projectable
guy. And they did that the rest of the way too, taking a lot of high upside.
Did you like the bottom end of their draft too, or
didn't really have a lot of opinions?
No, I
don't try to really game that stuff out.
So my Avs took Oscar Olsson in the first round, which I thought was, you said, might not have been as bad. I was a little disappointed, but
there were a lot of scouts I knew that had him in the top 20, and you know, he's a good skater, which really fits Colorado's profile.
They tend to take skaters.
Yeah,
I was the guys that I listened to that talk Avs stuff were a little disappointed. They said that he had strong Martin Kaut vibes, but maybe I like their second round pick a little bit better. A smaller defenseman, Sean Behrens, who was at USNTDP, who stepped up when, was it Hughes got hurt, right?
Hughes got hurt.
So Behrens stepped into his role and played a lot of power play and penalty kill. And someone even, I think on Twitter that I liked, said if he was 2 inches taller, he probably would have been a lottery pick. But he's small and kind of scrawny, but he's a puck mover, a decent skater. I thought a little bit like Girard. Somebody compared him more to Jared Spurgeon.
Well, Jared Spurgeon's going to be your go-to for any undersized defenseman.
For that kind of guy. And then they took a guy named Andre Bialski from Kazakhstan, I think. And no one really had heard a whole lot of Kazakh. Is that what they are? Kazakh, I guess,
yep.
Players. He's a very big center, but he's an overager. 2 year overager. I think he's 20. And so we'll see sort of how his skills translate against older players. But I don't know. And then the last guy that was kind of interesting was they took Taylor McCarr, who is Cale McCarr's little brother, about a few hours after they signed him to a 6 year, $45 million deal, which was sort of the big RFA signing of the offseason, I would say, in the NHL. Did you have an opinion on that contract?
He's fine. He'll probably actually exceed it in terms of value.
Yeah, and I was hearing that he probably could have gone higher.
He probably could have been in the 10 to 11 range.
But I think that then he probably would have had to go 8 years. I think the compromise was the 6 to 8 versus 9.
Well, because then you can get the second massive deal.
Exactly. Yeah. And so now he'll potentially have a chance to play with his brother. I don't know if that'll actually come to fruition. It would be nice.
Highly unlikely, but
maybe for a game at the end of the season, they'll bring him up. The Islanders took, and you and I kind of talked about this a little bit. This was, my Islanders took Atu Ratti, who was in conversation.
Apparently, it's Atu Ratu.
With a Y at the end?
Correct. That the Ratti is just pronounced Ratu. I don't know why it's not spelled like the first name is spelled, but
Atu Ratu.
Yep.
That's a name. Yep. I feel like
his brother's name is Aku Ratu.
It's like he was a strong Foreman vibes
here.
Yeah,
he was a mid-round pick a couple years back.
So he was a guy, though, that was supposed to be in the conversation for number one overall a couple years ago.
Ratu is why sports psychologists have a job, because no one denies the skills are still there, but something happened in his brain, and he just isn't playing the same confident way. He doesn't look comfortable out there, and I don't know if it's him being projected as the future number one overall just broke him mentally, or he cracked under pressure, or what happened. But, you know, it's a gamble. Everyone agrees that the talent is still very much there, but he was awful this year.
6 points in 35 games, I think, is what
he wouldn't have been drafted, probably, if he hadn't had that preceding year.
Is some of this like the COVID type of stuff where you have to switch? People are switching leagues. Nothing is kind of the same. There's no real continuity to the entire year.
I don't know.
Does that play into it?
I don't know. I mean, there was a lot going on there. There was the bad production. There was the fact he was cut from Finland's WJC roster, even though he had been there the year before as an underager. There was just a lot there. I mean, I personally would not have touched him until probably the third round. There were so many things that make me nervous hearing. But if you had a good interview with him, I mean, I've never talked to him, so I don't know what the story is. But teams have. And if you had a good interview and you feel like, you know, the brain isn't broken and that you can get to him, then, yeah, the talent's there.
And then he scored 4 goals later that day, which was, what, 2/3 of his production from the previous season? I thought it was pretty interesting. Then they took a massive goalie in Tristan Lennox, and then a guy named Cameron Berg from I believe, I think it was Dubuque maybe in the USHL. The interesting
Fighting Saints.
The interesting thing to me about that pick was that it was the, I was hoping for Dylan Duke because it was the pick right before Duke was taken with the Lightning. And when the Lightning came up and took him, I was like, well, that's probably a smart move. And
yeah,
I mean, Berg had good numbers and he's a bigger center. And so there's people are projecting him as maybe even a two or three or four center. third or fourth line center. So, you know, he might be a guy, you know, we just know Duke because we've been following him because of Michigan. So,
well, Duke was higher on a lot of boards too. So
he fell probably two rounds.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. I will also note that, again, your prospects are always more valuable than you think they are. And in the draft, outside of the first round, if you can just get one regular contributor per draft outside the first round, you're in a good spot.
You're doing really well. Yeah. Any other teams before we, this is, segment's running a little bit long, but I just want to touch on this. Is there any other teams?
Well, this was the meat of the podcast too.
But. Well, that's fair. Are there any other teams that you thought had a good draft? I know Minnesota, people were saying Minnesota had a pretty good first round.
Minnesota had some nice picks. They had two first rounders. I mean, I liked Winnipeg in taking Chaz Lucius pretty late. I wasn't a huge Lucius fan, but at that point the value was really good.
Yeah.
Since our old friend the Ottawa Senators was once a recurring theme on this podcast.
Yeah, until, you okay. know, do we need to get into this about
that
how
might
you
be
just,
in the second segment.
You're like,
well, so here's the problem.
You're not pretty enough. I want the pretty Toronto Maple Leafs so that they can blow a 3-1 series lead and just like inflict more pain on myself.
The Senators, who recently hired our old friend Pierre McGuire from NBC.
He might be your old friend. I've never met him.
Well, they had a draft. You know, what you can say is that they did their own scouting. They took a guy, the 10th overall pick, who was not seen as in the top 50 on most internet scouts boards and just baffled people. It was rumored that he was in the higher on NHL lists because he's number one comp is Tom Wilson. And
that's great.
Everyone wants that.
Is he also a douche?
I don't know. What I know is he plays with an edge. And
well, playing with an edge and Tom Wilson are two very different things.
And they just kind of kept doing that the whole draft, taking guys like 100 picks before they were supposed to be taken and just sort of saying, well, this is what we're doing.
Is it because the analytics teams like Edmonton were bounced early in the NHL playoffs?
I think they think that they have all of their core pieces and that they don't need any more good players. They need tough players now, which I do like their core a lot, and I think they're set up in a good spot, but you can never stop adding good players.
I was going to say, the Avs have a lot of really good players, and you know what I want on their drafts? More good players.
And I think any time you get in that position where you're just penciling in your notes like, well, our top 10 prospects are going to be our top two lines and our top two defensive pairs, you're going really badly. Because, like, only half of those, maybe, will be good players.
Yeah.
And, like, if you're sitting there saying, well, we have all the good players we need when you, you know, just finish with, like, the eighth worst record.
Better start winning cups.
That's a bad sign. Like, I don't know. That was a little weird. That's what I'll say. But, again, props for not doing the groupthink thing.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Alexander, you did a really good thing this summer. Like, when I was asking you what you did, you neglected to talk about this, so now I have to toot your horn. So if you can give me your horn, I'd like to toot it, because you wrote are in the process of, I guess, writing a really nice series on, like, the basics of hockey. And you looked at, like, breakouts, some neutral zone stuff, some end zone entries, forechecking, and then power play and penalty kill. And that's not something that we have gone in depth at this site before. So you mentioned it might be a good idea to talk through some of this stuff. This may not be the longest segment you've ever listen to, but I think it's a good idea to just kind of walk people through it if they want to hear it from an audible standpoint. So do you want to start in your own zone and work through breakouts, or how do you want to go about this?
Sure. I mean, we had one sort of piece looking at transition play from defensive zone to offensive zone with breakouts, regroups, and counters, or zone exits, as another way to call breakouts. But,
right.
You know, the actual strategy component, I think you, whoever is listening to this, can go read the pieces. I won't go too much into that. But, you know, the basic tenets of transition play is the idea that, you know, as a goal, it is always better to enter or exit a zone with possession.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you are building your offensive zone, you know, your offensive transition game, you want to gear it around being able to generate controlled zone exits and controlled zone entries. And on the flip side, when you're building your forecheck, your goal is to prevent those in both the offensive and
skating
the
skating and passing,
zone.
Not dumping and chasing, more or less.
Sure. Because, you know, entering the zone with possession, especially in the offensive zone, leads to more scoring chances at a higher rate. As opposed to just dumping it in and having these sort of long, grinding possessions that take a long time to generate a good look.
Yeah, and you mentioned something in your post in that sense, that if you don't get a great look right away, the odds of you getting a great look in that particular entry
five-on-five
are not as high.
I mean, and obviously, you know, rush chances, those kinds of controlled entries are generally generating a lot better scoring chances than, you know, forechecking sequences in the offensive zone, though some teams build around that. And we should note that, you know, very much the new sexy thing to do is to build your team around these controlled exits and entries. And, you know, a lot of people who are really into strategy definitely hold up those teams as the shining examples, be it Colorado or Vegas or, you know, the Maple Leafs or another team like that.
Do you think that comes from the fact that of the higher-end talent, where if we can get our five guys in the zone versus your five guys, we can get into good, better positions
because of our elite skill? The fact is that Tampa and Carolina are generally more forecheck-based teams. They dump and chase a lot. Hmm. They're not a very sort of controlled entry-type team, which is just the way they choose to play, and those teams both have a lot of talent.
Yeah.
So it isn't the only way to do things, but I will say that at least Carolina and Tampa do have some guys that can play in the rush, be it Aho or Braden Point, and they have defensemen who can jump up on plays with Hedman and Dougie Hamilton. So
and quick looking at Michigan has players that can skate the puck out.
Yep,
and that's
the most, you know, I think, forgotten thing about Quinn Hughes or his saving grace, even during a very tumultuous second season where things were rough a lot of the time. He was the only guy on Michigan's defensive core who could handle zone entries and zone exits with possession.
And he was very good.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say he didn't turn it over, as everybody remembers in a number of different ways, but the first part of that was not really in question.
Yeah.
And Luke is going to be...
Luke can do
kind
it.
Of like
Nick
that.
Blankenberg can do it. Owen Power can do it to some extent. Like, Michigan's well covered there.
Yeah.
And forwards tend to handle zone entries more than defensemen. Defensemen chip in a little bit, but it tends to be more forwards that do the zone entries. And Michigan's also well covered there. I mean, Beniers is, at the collegiate level, an almost automatic zone entry a lot of times. And Bortolo was quite good
Bortolo's
at that last,
right there too.
Last season. And even John Beecher, because he's strong and he also is fast. Can get up and down the ice with the puck. So, I mean, they're well covered in that regard, and that's the advantage of having talent, too.
Yeah, when you get a bunch of NHL draft picks, you would hope that they're going to be able to do something like that against most teams that are not going to have quite as many NHL draft picks.
It was a lot less fun when you were asking Jacob Hayhurst to do your zone entries.
I was never a Hayhurst hater.
I was not a Hayhurst hater either, but that was not really his skill set.
That's probably true, even though his stick handling was pretty good.
Yeah. And so, you know, on the flip side, you have forechecking.
Forechecking, yes.
And there were some questions in the comments about sort of what the term refers to. And it is, when we talk about X player is a good forechecker. For example, Nolan Moyle is a good forechecker, mm-hmm. you might say. Or
Van Wy.
You know, Van Wy at Michigan, you know, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. That refers almost exclusively to offensive zone forechecking.
Right, like around the net.
Yeah.
Not once you get to
the ability to retrieve pucks in the offensive zone, and to some extent the defensive zone, too. Your ability to battle in the corners, those kinds of things. That's what that refers to.
Sort of like the grindy boards, greasy guys. Yeah.
But what teams that do not have the puck in the neutral zone and in the offensive zone revert to as a strategy is also referred to as a forecheck. Either an offensive zone forecheck or a neutral zone forecheck.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, your offensive zone forecheck is more aggressive because your goal in the offensive zone forecheck is to keep the puck in the offensive zone and recover it.
To turn it over and to have a chance on goal.
To get it back.
Right. Neutral zone, you don't get a chance on goal if you take it there.
Hockey is a shoot and retrieve game, and I don't think we talked about that enough last year on this podcast. But that's really all it is. You shoot. And either it goes in or it doesn't, and then you get it back.
Sort of like offensive rebounding.
Kind of. I mean, it's a shoot and retrieve game. And so, as a result, you know, you devise these forechecking strategies as a team to recover the puck, either in the offensive or the neutral zone. And again, the offensive zone, the forecheck's going to be a bit more aggressive. You tend to have players hitting the offensive boards hard, sort of pushing the play up to the boards where you have the defenseman at the 2 points pinching in to keep it in the zone, that kind of thing. Whereas in the neutral zone, it's a little more passive, and teams kind of can do different things, and it depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, what your system is. Like you mentioned, different sorts of traps and stuff like that.
They don't come
into play in the offense or in the forechecking part. I'm sorry, in the offensive zone. I mean, there's parts of it, but usually the traps take place more so in the neutral zone.
And what your goal with your neutral zone forecheck is trying to do is kind of a big thing. You know, the neutral zone trap, which can take many forms. You can do a 1-2-2. You can do a 1-3-1. You can do a 1-1-3, which is kind of, you know, become more popular.
Becoming vogue lately, yeah.
Yeah. And those attempt to do a to force a dump in by the opponent, to deny a controlled zone entry, to force a dump in. And to force the play to the boards. Those are that goal. A different system, perhaps more aggressive, but also using some of the same alignments. Like Vegas this season ran a 1-2-2 neutral zone forecheck, but it was not a trap. It was trying to create turnovers to then create transition play, because the Vegas was a very good rush team going the opposite way, capitalizing on turnovers. So some systems, the goal is going to be to just force a dump in and then create sort of this, you know, grinding possession the other way, then get it out, etc. Other teams are going to kind of sell out to force a turnover to try and get a rush chance the other direction. Depends on your strategy.
But for Michigan, I'm going to say in this particular case, if you're going to watch games this year, I would think
they will be more aggressive this season.
You're going to look at them and say, all right, if they're skating the puck out past their blue line and into across the opponent blue line and not trying to dump the puck out of their blue line and into the offensive zone to go scraggle in the corners, then they're getting to do what they want to do.
If Mel Pearson was kidnapped tomorrow and I was named the new coach of Michigan,
who would be ahead of you in this list? Is there a long list? Like, is this a possibility?
I don't know. It's tough to say. There hasn't been a coaching search in a few years. We don't know who the candidates
are. Let's get that drain kit off that podcast.
But, I would go with the Tampa 1-1-3. I would, because it gives you that back line to deny the blue line. But because Michigan has great skaters, you can put a Beniers or a Bortolo there who at the NCAA level are going to be able to close gaps a lot quicker.
Right.
And they don't need more bodies to get on guys and to be really, you know, aggressive on a player. They can make up that space pretty quickly.
Because they're fast skaters.
Yeah, they don't need two extra teammates to help them be aggressive. They can just do it themselves. And so I think that would probably be the best system. That's kind of what Tampa's done. They put their back line back there, and then they have Barkley Goodrow or Blake Coleman or Braden Point or whoever up front who are all very tenacious and rather quick at these skill sets, who then
Just go hunting.
I mean, the reason the 1-1-3s become popular is because you get that back line that allows you to be kind of trappy. But if you have aggressive forecheckers up front, you can also let them be aggressive.
Yeah.
Knowing that they have that safety blanket behind them.
So should we move to special teams?
Sure.
So you wrote a couple articles about this. I thought the power play one was especially good. I mean, it's kind of more or less like there are a couple options, but usually good teams, when Michigan's had their best best lines on the ice over the years, they've a lot of times tried to go to that 1-3-1. I mean, that goes back to the CCM line of Comfort, Mott, and Connor with Werenski. I just kind of lost in there for a second. And I think Alex Kyle was on that too. So you basically just kind of have a big plus sign throughout the ice, and you have one guy sitting at the back taking up a lot of space, and then two shooters on the wings, a bumper guy in the middle, and then a slam guy up front who's going to put in rebounds and screen goalies. And, like, that's just when you have the pieces, it's mostly pretty much what you do.
Yeah, for the most part, that's become the most popular thing.
And it works, I mean, right? I mean, if you have shooters...
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that I didn't delve much into this in the piece because it was kind of dense and would take a lot to talk about. There's a lot of debates right now about how important the net front guy is.
Okay.
Some people prefer a system where you have, rather than a net front guy, a guy kind of on the goal line, off to the side, who sort of uses the, you know, the fabled Gretzky's office angle to make passes into the high danger area, especially if you're from behind the net, which is where Gretzky did a lot of his work, because the goalie can't see it, and you can quickly get it into the high danger zone between the dots. I understand that argument. If you have a really good passer back there, I think you could do it with Kent Johnson there. But the flip side is that the reason you have the net front guy is that you have to get some motion in front of the goalie.
Yeah.
Because of the goalie, you know, at the NCAA level, maybe not as much, certainly the NHL level, if a goalie is seeing a shot all the way on the power play, it's going to be saved.
Pretty much.
There's a few guys, yes, Dreisaitl, Ovechkin, Matthews, Stamkos, who can shoot like that and can just power it by a goalie, but certainly there are not a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
And so you need to get something. One way to do that, even if you're not screening, is change of sides.
Right.
And change of sides is the most dangerous pass. It gets the goalie moving across the crease, and if they lose it for just a split second, they're behind the play the whole time.
Sort of like reversing the ball in basketball.
Yeah.
When you get the defense on one side and you can reverse it, a lot of times you can get an open three.
And so what really works for the 1-3-1, especially what Tampa did, I mean, Tampa single-handedly won their first two series on the power play.
Yeah.
They were not particularly good at 5-on-5, but they just poured it in at like 40% in those two
series.
Against
them. Yeah. Like, it was a goal.
What it really works for them is that they have guys at both half walls who can shoot and can pass. And so you have Stamkos, who's more of the shooter, but also can pass really well. And Kucherov's more of the passer, but he can also shoot really well. And when you've got two guys there that are dual threat options who can both pass and shoot at a high level, it's just a nightmare.
And does Michigan have guys that are like that at the NCAA level?
I think that's where you would want to see growth from Kent Johnson or Beniers as shooters, and you would want to see growth from Brisson as a passer.
Yeah, because they would tee him up for shots on the dot.
Yeah, and Bordalo would do that a lot, too.
Yeah.
But Bordalo, I think, is probably the best mix of shooting and passing that the Michigan had last season.
Okay.
Maybe Beniers. But, you know, that's where individual improvement comes into handy. And also having a defenseman at the point who can move the puck around is pretty valuable, too.
Which they should have in... So that could be interesting because they had on power play one, I think they had Cam York, and he was the only guy.
Yeah,
then the second unit had Blankenberg and Power.
I tend to prefer four forwards and a defenseman, and actually in this situation, I would probably prefer Blankenberg just because I think his wrist shot's really good.
Okay,
but if Power gets a little more on his slap shot, it's valuable. You know, the point shot isn't the most valuable power play. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that teams that are just bombing it from the point into bodies are not really taking high-percentage shots at the Winnipeg Jets, but and Canadians to some extent. But it's also true, if you don't have a guy that can shoot there, it can hold you back. And like a lot of Toronto's troubles on the power play last year, which made no sense given the talent on their power play unit, had to do with the fact that no one respects Morgan Rielly as a shooter. And even though he's a really creative guy and can move the puck and is a beautiful skater for a defenseman. He can't shoot.
Kind of like Nick Letty.
And that
used
was
to
a problem that Quinn Hughes had at Michigan. And Quinn has improved dramatically as a shooter. I mean, I brought this up several times.
Yes, you did.
He is a lot better as a shooter at the NHL than he was in college. I mean, he was not a guy that... How many slap shots do you remember him taking? He would shoot in the wrist shot.
He had a few, but not
many.
It wasn't really part
of
his
game. And it
was
a bit of a problem.
He would look to get low and have a dish for a dunk instead of a bomb.
But he's gotten a lot better as a shooter. And I think if Power, I mean, Power's got the size. I mean, obviously you're not going to have Shea Weber on your team, but you don't need that at the NCAA level. And Power's got the size to expect a big shot out of him.
Yeah.
And his shot was decent last year.
So
but
you could even put one on power play one and one on power play two.
That's probably how I would do it. I mean, it depends on what's going on in the practices. I think an option would be Blankenberg power play one or power play one, and then do the other one and Hughes on the second unit.
Oh, interesting. So then you'd put two.
The tough thing is Michigan's going to have so many guys that are good at offense that you could actually build two good units, and your problem then becomes, like, what do you do? Because I'm of the opinion that if you are a team with elite talent, like if you have Makar, MacKinnon, Rantanen, Landis, Cog, if you have Matthews, Marner, Nylander, Tavares, if you have Kucherov, Stamkos, Palat, Hedman, I don't want to see a second unit.
No, you
put those two guys out there the full 2 minutes, put those guys out, and just let them go to work. And then they'll get a break after it's done. But, I don't want to see Nazem Kadri leading a power play unit. I don't want to see Alex Kerfoot leading a power play unit.
He was their fifth player, but...
Sure, I'm just throwing someone out there. Jonas Donskoy, et cetera, that kind of player.
That's what the Avs would do, is they would basically play about 80 seconds with their number one unit. And then the second unit would basically
I would prefer even more than that, honestly.
Half a shift.
I mean, that's what the Oilers have done, but that's in part because they have literally no other players.
They don't have a second unit.
I mean, there was that one game where McDavid and Draisaitl were out there for like the last 5 minutes of the game.
just didn't have legs.
But like that, they don't even really have a second unit. It's just that unit, and that's it for the 2 minutes, and which I'm fine with. I mean, again, we don't need to see Jujhar Khaira or Zach Kassian or Josh Archibald trying to play on the power play. So
you're having some quite deep references going here.
I just like to throw out some names. And speaking of strategy... The penalty kill strategy has also changed a bit, where there's a lot of discussion now among people who, you know, are sickos and watch a lot of games.
Are you included in this?
Yeah, probably. and now it's become kind of in vogue that you should just put two of your best offensive forwards who can still handle a little bit of defense out there to push the other team
out of the zone
in terms and put pressure on them. If they turn it over, now it's
a breakaway, or now it's a 2-on-1.
And a few teams did that really well. Like, Marchand and Bergeron are one of the teams, at least at one point this season, had outscored the opposing power play when they were out there as a penalty kill.
But they're also good offensive and defensive
They're
players.
Also really good defensive players.
Right.
Marchand's a really good defensive player. Bergeron might be the best defensive forward to ever play in the league.
Right.
But here's the other examples. Mark Stone and Chandler Stephenson in Vegas at one point in the year were also outscoring the opposing power plays when they were out there. Stone's a great defensive player. Stephenson, not as much. But they're both fast. Well, Stone's gotten faster. Stephenson's really fast.
Yeah.
And they have the ability for Stone to create the turnover and then Stephenson to get the breakaway. And it worked really well. And Aho and Natchez in Carolina were doing a similar thing. Both those guys are fast. And they're both guys that play on the top lines. And so there's now kind of an idea that, what if we just put Bortolo and Beniers out there on our top penalty kill?
Well, Beniers did play some PK.
Well, they did. But, you know, sort of that's kind of where it shifted, where in the past it was definitely the Van Wyse and the Moyles. The Red Wings in the old days would have maybe Yzerman or Dotz who play a little bit on the penalty kill, but then you'd have Draper and Maltby for 20 years doing that. And that's kind of the idea, because one thought is, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to stand around the net and we're going to block shots.
Yep.
And sometimes that works if you have really good shot blockers, can take away angles.
Yep.
It's more problematic if you're not blocking many shots and you're not taking away passing lanes, which was the 2018 Michigan Wolverine penalty kill.
Where you're just like holding on to anything around you anytime they go on the penalty kill.
So the idea of putting really good players on the penalty kill has now been called a power kill. That's the new,
is that what it
yeah,
is?
Yeah, that's the new...
Well, we might be able to use that next year.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, because we have Owen Power.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Come for the analysis, stay for the jokes.
So, it's just going to be an interesting question schematically what Michigan wants to do.
The reality is, on this team, when you're talking special teams, you're going to be picking from whatever you want. Like, yeah. there's not going to be a lot of people in specified roles that are going to be forced into slots. It's going to be like, if somebody isn't available, you're going to have 1A. And then you're going to have 1B probably in other. I mean, you and I could sit here and tinker around and maybe even come up with like 3 power play units.
Sure.
So, let alone penalty kills. And like you said, you could go sort of the power kill route, which, I mean, might just happen because those are great players.
Yeah.
But you could also go the old traditional Van Wymoyle and be fine there too. And that was one of the things that we noted in the second half of the year. What made them really good, penalty kill better, was Van Wy and Moyle getting a lot better.
They also learned to put their sticks on the ice, which was kind of a problem early in the year where they were not taking away changes.
Seems like something
passes.
You should know, but
you know, hey, they got there.
Yeah. So that was a really good series you did. Do you have any more that are coming?
Here's what I'll say. There will be a post on the board sometime in the near future. And also, those listening, any things you want to know or have had long questions about regarding hockey strategy, other things, let me know, and we'll do a mailbag. I know we've already gotten a question from an undisclosed individual about line changes, but I'll put something up on the board, and if anybody has any question, you know, any things that you've watched and you've never really understood, I'll try to answer all those, and that'll be the capper. And then maybe we'll get into looking at Michigan's strategies from last season, but that might also blade into football season, which I will have more things to do this year. That's a sneak peek. But
maybe you'll touch on that on sort of the hockey previews if there's sort of thing. We may have another podcast this summer. It's sort of to be determined. Michigan has not released their schedule, to my knowledge.
We're getting more information.
Like, pieces are leaking.
They are going to Duluth, right, for a tournament?
Somebody said something like that. I know UMass is coming here.
UMass is coming here, and the GLI is gone.
In Yost.
Yeah, it's gone. But
well, it's not. Yeah, which is, I mean, hey, that's short trip for us, right?
It's 2 days, 2 days of games.
Yeah,
where one day I think Tech comes and the other day Western comes, I think it is.
Is that who it is?
And then they reverse and the other two, and then they go like, they play one day in MSU and one day in
Michigan. Sort of like the College Hockey Showcase used to be years ago with Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah, so it's like Michigan and Michigan State both host 2 games against those 2 teams, and then those 2 teams just get one against the other.
Which is probably okay if they're going to keep running it the way that they did, the GLI at like 11:30 on New Year's Day or whatever. Was like, yeah, I don't think that's going to draw a lot of folks. But so we have pieces of it. If it looks like it's worth talking about and we get some news, we may come back and run it back, I guess, in the summertime. Otherwise, we will see you in the mid-fall.
Thank you for listening to Michigan HockeyCast 3.28. For Alex Drain and David Nasternak, this probably is it for Season 3, and if it is, we achieved 4 touchdowns and 4 extra points.